Welcome to Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast. My name is Ed Charbonneau. I am an artist whose main focus is on painting, and I am also an adjunct faculty member in the Fine Arts Department at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. This podcast presents a series of conversations about color, color usage, and optics as they relate to theories of human color perception in the making of visual art and design. Welcome to Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast. I'm delighted that today for our episode, I am joined by Sebastian Wilson, who is a photographer in Santiago, Chile. And I'd like to begin, Sebastian is here with us. I'd like to begin with reading his biography, and then we'll get into our conversation. Sebastian Wilson is a photographer from Chile. He studied architecture, which has a clear influence on his work, both in the graphic sense and on the way he looks at portraits in light. He has been published in books and magazines in Chile, Germany, Spain, United States, to name a few. His work on, quote, embodied light, unquote, the book about the Baha'i Temple in Chile by Hari Pontanari. Am I saying that correctly?
Hariri and Pontarini.
Harini and Pontarini, architect, is a great synthesis on his ability to capture the details of both the ephemeral presence of light and what is physically built. His images were used in the TED Talk about the temple titled, How Do You Build a Sacred Space? Sebastian has traveled through Chile, capturing the people, landscapes, and light of each region. He has sold a lot of his work to different galleries and clients looking to decorate their homes and spaces. He has worked with the photographer Guy Wenborn, where he has post-processed many of his images for books about Chile, capturing the color of each scene. His constant exploration on photography focuses on light and color, searching for different techniques, such as multiple exposures to reach an abstraction that can't be achieved through straight, quote unquote, photography. His commercial work always tries to stand out through the novel use of light. Sebastian has taught photography in institutes, schools, and individually focusing on the needs of each person. To view more of Sebastian's work, please visit his website at www.swl.cl or on Instagram at swl_photo, spelled F-O-T-O, on Instagram. And I should say that we have a website devoted to this episode, which you'll be able to find the links to in the show notes, where I have links to Sebastian's work. And additionally, as we talk today, we'll have links to other information that comes up throughout our conversation. How are you, Sebastian?
Thank you very much for the invitation, Ed. Good here in Chile with a bizarre spring, as we were talking a few minutes ago. We're getting close to summer now, but we had snow yesterday in the mountains, very cold. I'm okay. I'm good exploring light.
Thank you so much again for joining us. We met via the podcast. You were listening and wrote to me, sent me a really kind message around the beginning of July this past year. And so I really appreciated that. And as I was putting together this idea to do interviews and then following your work on Instagram, it kind of came together that we could do this interview together. Because I know our listeners out there, I hope you go and look at Sebastian's work. Is incredible. I'll have several images on the link to this episode. There's a whole lot else out there. And then following him on Instagram too, you get the daily dates and stuff of the current work. Yeah, well, getting into the interview proper then, how about for our first question, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the idea of What does color mean to you and your perception of the world that surrounds you? And also in terms of what artists have influenced your work. So that's kind of a three-part question. So what does color mean to you?
Color is very interesting, overwhelming at sometimes, because it's so vast and we can't still comprehend it completely. I'm usually staggered by the thing that it's called color theory instead of color facts. We don't know exactly what is color. We do talk about color, and a lot. We have books about it. We have paintings, and we have lots of people talking about color, but we don't know exactly what it is. Everybody sees it different. Everyone's perception is different. We feel about color in different ways. Sometimes we're going to think, for example, red is passion, blue is calm, green is hope. But sometimes we think more green is life. Or, for example, I was a couple of years ago in a rainforest in the southern part of Chile. We were in kind of a field, and it was this little patch of woods. And we got in there, and it was super green. Everything was green. Every tree was covered in moss, and it was very humid. I stepped in, and I said, I think I can breathe life or breathe green. Everything was alive. As I said, every branch you saw, everything was alive with different mosquitoes and plants and moss and mushrooms. And I can't even think I can name everything I saw in just a square inch. And again, color was very important because I saw green. Obviously, you see millions of different hues of green. You don't see just one green. Since I was very little, I was very interested in color because there's not only red, yellow, and blue. Mm. I always knew there were many more. For example, when I was a kid, I found out that I could mix my pencils to maybe the shadow was not always gray or like black.
Right.
It had different colors. Maybe it had some blue. Or maybe it had some green or even red. But it was just something through my mind. My parents, my mom, used to paint a lot, like amateur painting, but she did oil painting. And my dad always took photographs of us. It came from his dad also. So we had also a lot of National Geographic and a lot of books at home of photographs. So since I was very little, I could see a lot of colors and a lot of images around. And I think that stuck, it's still stuck to the day with color and images and light. So I could always see it in a different way or more as a personal thing than instead of a just thing that it is. Like, this is light and that's it. Don't question it.
Yeah, because you were noticing the subtleties of the shadows. As a young person, well, that is fascinating. And the way you described going into that field of green in the jungle, where it becomes overwhelming like that as an experience, it's like a total phenomenological thing or something. Is that what it is?
I think it is something very ancestral for us, like to see green. We've been, I don't know how many centuries, in cities or towns or villages. Right. We have escaped nature. And when I got in there, I felt like this ancestral or atavistic thing about green, about this cover of green. I forgot the word again. Cobijo. It's like shelter.
A shelter, right? Like you're enveloped.
Exactly. The color shelters us from the outside. Yes, phenomenology is something that I've been trying to understand. It's not easy. The other day I read about something that made more sense, like give explanation to something you feel.
Right.
More or less words. But Stephen Hall, the architect, talks about a lot about phenomenology.
Okay.
And in his buildings, I think I could understand this phenomenology that he's talking about. And again, to this rainforest I was in, I could give a lot of meaning to this color and to this light that I was receiving. It is spotted the light, or it's green and it's cold. No, as I said, I sense something more like shelter, more like protection, the elements.
Well, because you're trained as an architect, and it's like an architectural space designed by nature.
Yes, exactly. Well, architecture gave me a lot of that view of the world, especially with light. I think buildings are, besides something that gives us shelter, it's something that manages light. It directs light. It points us at something that's very interesting, maybe, in the building with light. You don't need a spotlight like a lamp. You can do it through architecture. And again, there are millions of things that I want to put in the interview.
just keep going.
Come to my head, for example, all the Japanese architecture, they use little light, but the light that they use is enough to make you feel something again. There is one very nice book by Junichiro Tanizaki. I forgot the name in English, but it's El Elogio de la Sombra. It would be In Praise of Shadows. That's the name.
Oh, wonderful. In Praise of Shadows.
In Praise of Shadows. It talks about architecture, modern, quote-unquote, architecture in Japan in the 1930s. And he talks about, for example, the ritual of going to the bathroom. Nowadays, explaining in the 1930s, everyone wants the white ceramic, the white WC.
Yep.
And he said, in Japan, we had the bathroom outside. You had to walk through a little forest from the house to get to the bathroom. And it was wooden, so you had the smell and the sense of the patina of time in this wood. And you sat down to do your business, to do your natural business, I think it was called.
Yeah.
You had a little window in the bathroom that you could see the green outside of this forest. And it said, how exquisite this ritual of going to the bathroom. That's something we do like nowadays. They, okay, we have to go quickly. And they sense it as a ritual.
Amazing. Going back to the green.
Yes, again. And I remember that your last podcast with Jeremy, that you talked about the painter that paints landscape with no green.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about that myself as we're talking. Yeah, that was a funny bit there. Well, it's so personal, isn't it? It's so experiential. That's why I was kind of interested the way you described that place in the jungle, and some of the architectural references that you've sent me, like Stephen Hall, and just how clearly they are working with light in the spaces. And that reminded me of The Poetics of Space by, hold on, let me grab that book. Of course, I'm not finding it in my bookshelf, but, and an uncle of mine is an architect who's been a mentor for many years. And so I'm kind of used to hearing him talk about architectural spaces, and also the kind of inside outside and the way light affects the space. I guess I'm struggling to tie together what it is I'm going for. Well, just kind of looking for that connection of the natural world and a built world, and then bringing it around to your photography. How do you see these worlds coming together in like what are like flat images, 2D spaces?
Well, I always try to to go back to the etymology of photography. That it comes from two Greek words, phos, that is light, and graphis, that is writing or designing. So it's writing or designing with light. At first, I thought it was so poetic and very nice, but it doesn't mean anything. But after working as a photographer, I found out the real meaning of writing or designing with light. I started looking at light in a different way. I once read about the sensor of the camera. It's like a canvas. For a painter, you have the white canvas. For the photographer, it's the sensor where you capture the light. And it said, I said, like, okay, you have this canvas. You have a fixed image in front of you that you're going to print, quote unquote, in the sensor. But you can do something about it. You maybe can have a longer shutter where you can capture more light and you can put movement in this flat, static base. Or you can maybe give this feeling of movement with just the movement of the camera. Or, for example, multiple exposures. I use a lot. Some of the images I sent were multiple exposures, where you start to add light and more light to your one picture. As I said, the straight picture, the straight is what you see is what you get. What I see is the beginning. It's one of the pictures. It's a monkey puzzle, the tree. Then I took 10 pictures of that same tree and I circled it around, and the camera makes it on its own. In the olden days, you didn't pass the film. Instead of passing the film, you took again another picture and again, kind of printed the picture many times on the same film. And nowadays you can do it on the computer, but I prefer to do it on camera. So I started walking around this monkey puzzle, 10 pictures, it's the most that I can have in the camera, around this tree. So I said, more or less, I was just walking in this field alone. I said, this is more or less a circle, and I'm going to circle around the tree, taking pictures. So the camera made this. It looks like
yeah, which image is that on? Is that the black and white one?
Black and white, yeah.
Well, like it creates a composite?
Yes. Like an engraving.
Stretch.
There was a name, the name. Like it's like an engraving.
Very much looks like a printed etching.
Yeah. And it's just pictures of the same tree, of me walking around the tree.
Amazing.
So that's light working on my brain in that case. It's not color. I said, okay, light.
Right.
I have to add light from different sides to make this kind of an etch tree.
Right. It's as if the light is etching itself into the frame itself, the digital space.
To the canvas, quote-unquote canvas.
Canvas, yes.
You as a painter, you have a white canvas, and you have to start with that, and you can create whatever you want.
Yeah.
I have a sensor. I said, okay, this is going to capture whatever it sees in front. Let's work with it.
Right, and you're using time as part of that process, like walking around multiple exposures.
Exactly. So finally, that image that you say, usually a picture takes one click and maybe a hundredth of a second, a thousandth of a second.
Sure.
I'll be 5 minutes doing just one picture.
Yeah.
I could do it in Photoshop, but I don't like it. And I prefer to do it in situ, in the places. And well, the other part that you said, like a 2D medium that is photography.
Mm.
With light, and by lighting the subject correctly, you can give volume and you can have more of a 3D sense, feeling of 3D. But well, anyways, you're going to see it in a screen or printed. But the way you can have volume is through light and through working with it. Going back to the etymology of photography is writing or designing with light.
Designing with light. Right, because some of your work, it feels like you are representing the space around things, like the space of the sky. There's like a cityscape looking image. And also, this is very well. And going back to that tree image, and you mentioned like how it forms in our mind. The image itself, when you said mind, it looks like an aerial view of a brain, of like the neurons.
I have it printed here, so that's why I'm looking. I never saw it that way.
And I'm fascinated too by the idea of thinking about the camera as the light sensor itself, and that you're experiencing the light around you, and that is what is. Well, is it that is what is drawing you to the subject matters? If the subject matter is the light, is it the experience of the space or the place that becomes the subject of the photograph? Hence, some of them become very abstract, like hard to name, you know, the specific tree or the specific place.
Yeah, absolutely. For example, one of the pictures I sent, the 1515, two rectangles in a plain space, in a blank space. That is also a multiple exposure of the first rays of sun through a window. It was very early morning. I read about something that was very interesting. It said, we live in a camera. I said, okay. If you see the camera as the concept, you have a little hole where light comes in and it is, quote unquote, printed on the other way, on the other side. Like camera obscura, they used in the Renaissance, the painters, they used this black rooms with one hole on one side and the canvas on the other side, so they could paint over the image that was reflected on this canvas. Every window we have is a lens, and we have the image printed on our walls. Usually it's not very clear since it's a very big window. It's not a small hole where light comes in. So we have a lot of light coming in. But for example, yesterday I closed the curtains. We have blackout curtains in one of the rooms. So I had a small sliver of light coming in. And it was enough to make a camera obscura and kind of thing. And it reflected the colors of the sunset in my wall.
Wow.
It is inverted. That's the only bizarre thing. So it's like, okay, the other way around. But it's very interesting to, again, think about light and how light is basically everything around us. And we live in a camera in that sense. We capture light through our eyes, and our brain is in charge of understanding what we see.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's right, strange. So we're all walking around inside of these camera obscuras. It's just that the aperture of the windows are so large, it's letting in so much light that we can't perceive.
Can't perceive it. It's out of focus.
It's out of focus by the time it hits the wall on the other side.
Exactly, but for example, there's a very easy experiment. Not very easy nowadays because not everyone has a magnifying glass. But if you have a magnifying glass, you have a window on one side, and you put the magnifying glass close to the wall on the opposite side of that window, the magnifying glass is going to act as a lens of the camera.
Yeah.
And you're going to have in focus all the image you have from outside in your wall. I taught my kids about it, and they were like, what?
Yeah.
What's going on? I said, yeah. What you see there, this magnifying glass, this very basic, is going to project everything it sees outside inverted on the wall.
Well, and that's what's happening inside of human eyes.
Exactly, yeah.
And then our minds flip it right back upside, because the image is upside down when the wavelengths pass through the lens.
I read about if you covered one eye and you had a pair of glasses that inverted the image, So you saw the other way around.
Yeah.
Brain would get used to it. And finally, it will flip the image again.
Flip it back.
Flip it back. So that makes me wonder, what are we seeing? What is reality?
What are we seeing? Yes.
And color is real or not? For example, Edwin Land, the creator of Polaroid.
Sure.
He had the Retinex concept he talked about. He said, maybe we see in black and white, but the brain finally gives us the color. And it made a lot of sense when I started thinking about, what about colorblind people?
Yes.
They see the same colors as us. They should see the same colors, but maybe their brain is giving them a different reading of the wavelengths.
Right.
Maybe not the cones or...
It's very mysterious because it is just wavelengths.
Yeah.
Color is not inherent to the object. It is a collection of wavelengths that produce the sensation of color in our minds.
Exactly. And the wavelengths are equal for all of us.
Right. And so how they're perceived and the mechanisms, the physical mechanisms.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's why it's overwhelming.
Yeah, it gets overwhelming. Well, and you cite too, James Turrell talks about, there's an interview with Charlie Rose that we can link to this, to the episode, where he is speculating on how is it that we see light in our dreams when our eyes are closed.
Exactly. All our memories are very colorful and with light. Why?
And how true is that to everyone as well? Like, some people may, I haven't studied this much, but maybe some people may only dream in black and white. Or is it always full color? Well, just that question of going back to the mystery of it, because dreams are not solely collections of memories that are rearranged, put into a new series of events or something. Like, I had a dream the other night where I woke up and there was this guy in my dream and he was wearing this yellow and black plaid shirt. And for some reason, I thought that was really strange. When I woke up, I immediately thought, like, how is it that I constructed that? Why yellow and black? That comes from nowhere that I can think of. So, you know what I mean?
It must be something. That's it, the overwhelming thing again. It's why?
The why.
Once I dreamt that someone killed me. I was walking in the street with an uncle. We were talking. And my whole night was compressed in like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
I woke up and I said, that was the night? Because I dreamt I was walking with my uncle. And suddenly a guy came in front of me, held a gun in his head, and in my head, and pulled the trigger, and boom, that's it. And then my dad woke me up, you have to go to school. That's it.
Yeah, how do you go to school after something like that?
And how did I go to black?
Yeah.
I was walking in the street in broad daylight and someone shot me and then I went to black.
Wow. So when you died in your dream, you everything went black. Like,
went black. Yeah. And then they woke me up.
That is.
With time to go to school. That it was
to school.
The worst part.
That would have been a strong argument to get the day off in my mind. They're like, Dad, you don't know what I just went through. Give me a break here. Yeah, like all this mystery, because looking back to that image of the window light on the wall, it really has that mystery about it. You know, myself looking at it, I immediately tied the image to what I thought was like the light on the wall from a window across the room. So I instantly named it. And yet, it is so ethereal that, because the wall isn't really defined, that light could be, those could be two ribbons hanging in space that are illuminated.
Two screens,
you know, so are.
And again, with now more than ever with AI, we don't know what's real.
Right.
With Photoshop, we used to not know. Now we have less idea what is real.
We for sure don't know.
Precisely on what we are seeing. That's the thing that I also was thinking about the different colors we see. First, we saw pigments and what was painted in a canvas or printed in a magazine. Then we see colors all around us, but now we have this other part of color that's the one that's shot at us by a size for a screen.
Right.
Maybe a computer screen or a telephone screen, but we have this little light sources shooting color at us. It's going to be very different from what we see in the real life. So again, what is color?
And these spaces.
And how the screen interprets color and how each app or software reads color. And when I started in photography, I say, okay, we have JPEG files and that's it.
Yep.
Now I know there are a million of different kind of files.
Yep.
And how each computer and each screen and each software reads color in different ways. For example, Instagram is in sRGB, and I usually work in my camera in Adobe RGB.
Yeah.
It has a lot more colors and hues than sRGB.
Yeah.
If you export an image in Adobe RGB and you put it in Instagram is going to convert it to sRGB, and it's not going to work very good.
You lose a lot of the subtleties, yeah.
And it changes colors. I have one picture in my feed in Instagram that has one kind of color, and if you swipe to the right to the other, the real version that it's in sRGB, is going to show the real colors that I wanted to portray in the picture.
Yeah, because the kicker is that, well, I've been thinking about this for years, is that people are going to experience a photograph, a digital image of my work before they see the actual object, and may never see the actual object.
They see that the object, maybe it's not going to be what they were expecting. For example, the paintings by Jeremy
Schabinski, yeah.
I saw it in your website. They have a lot of very intense colors, but I don't know if in reality you're going to see that intensity in the color.
Right.
For example, with the paintings of Eve Klein.
Yes.
I had this little book about Eve Klein. I said, oh, what a nice blue. But what you see there is not exactly the blue that he paints. A couple of years ago, I went to Paris and I saw one of his paintings in the Pompidou Center. And it's really amazing. The blue draws you in, it captures you, and it's quote unquote just blue.
Right. Just one color.
But it's amazing. I don't know what does it have that it's daunting. I don't know the word exactly, but.
Well, it's back to the green of where we started with this conversation. It's a full experience. But looking at the book is a full experience as well. They're all happening. It's just that under different circumstances, they impact us in different ways, I guess. Is that a way to?
Yeah, it's again, phenomenology. I mean, why do some people react in this way to the blue, or maybe the other? It's like, are you calmed down or are you like energized with blue? I don't know. If you feel like space or broad daylight, I don't know. It can evoke so many things just by watching blue.
Yeah.
And in that case, when I was standing in front of this painting, it was a large painting. In feet, I don't know, but in meters, maybe 2 by 3 meters.
Wow. Like, yeah, yeah. That's big. Like 8 by 8 feet, 7 by 7 feet.
And I stood there for a couple of minutes watching blue.
Watching blue. Well, stuff like that always gets me because it takes up my peripheral vision as well. You know, it really expands, so you're really in it.
Yeah.
I get the sense from your photos and thinking about architectural spaces and natural spaces, and even going back to the the bathroom situation that you described in Japan. What was the title of the book? Shadows. What Shadows Teach Us?
In Praise of Shadows.
In Praise of Shadows. Well, there's a certain poetry there that doesn't lead to a conclusion. It suggests something that I can kind of run with. And the way that you're talking about color, to me, is evoking the same kind of continually referring to like a mystery. It's suggesting something that I can enter into without telling me how it is. Ed, you should be doing this, that, or another thing, or you should feel this. Your work and the way that kind of we're talking about color right now, and you're talking, is not didactic like that. It's more like a celebration of the mystery of just the experience.
Yes, it's not like architecture where you can put a physical shape to color. It's a mystery. For example, I traveled once to Seattle to the St. Ignatius Chapel by Stephen Hall.
Okay.
And it has one room, then it has a skylight, but with a red tinted window. So all the room is red. It's not illuminated by red lamps. You have a red that is very enveloping. Again, he used honey in the paint. So you had a smell and a texture in the walls.
Interesting.
He talks a lot about the haptic realm. Haptic, that you can sense it in every way. You can touch it, smell it, see it, feel it.
Yeah.
Phenomenology and haptic in this same room. And you went in the room and you had the urge to shut up, to be quiet, and your brain like stop functioning and just be there and soak in the red light. And it was a very warm space. I don't even remember the temperature of the space, but it feels warm, and not just warm, as I'm saying, in a feeling like warm to the right. Touch.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can feel the warmness, maybe even going back to the womb,
like right, it's safe.
Something safe, yeah, quiet, and even the painting with the paint with the honey makes more of a muted sound. You don't have echoes. You have more of a muted sound, like in a womb.
Yeah,
and just by painting the room in a different way, with illuminating the room with one skylight, that chapel is really a masterpiece in light and how he works with feelings you get in the place. From the outside, it's very simple. It's not even interesting from the outside.
Right.
But when you get in, you have also a sense of recollection. Yeah. No, I don't know if that's the word, but you feel like enveloped by the architecture.
Well, and often it sounds like it's so simple, just very, not a lot of bells and whistles.
Yeah, his work is a lot of simple things. And as a teacher said, honest materials.
Honest, yeah.
For example, when you have concrete walls, if you use the scaffolding with the, not scaffolding, the, I think it's called scaffolding. When you take the wood, you have the wood like kind of printed over the...
Oh, sure, sure. From pouring the concrete.
So you can touch the concrete and you can touch the wood that was there. It's no longer there.
Yeah.
But you can see the texture. And it's very interesting. And Stephen Hall uses that a lot. But we think at very basic materials used in such a way that it's very spiritual, even to see that work. And again, with light and how light touches these walls and the shadows that they give on each square inch of this material, that's, you can say it's granite or it's concrete.
Right. It
works in such a way that it's very touching. And again, I was remembering what I put in my bio about the book Embodied Light.
Yes.
When they told me the title of the book, I said, like, wow, that was it. That was the word, the exact word what I was looking for in my pictures. How can I show light in a book that it's printed? It's yeah. not shooting light at us, but how can I show light in this, in the materials that they use, feeling that you get when you're in the temple. In the TED Talk, they used a couple of my images. One of them is when Siamak, the architect, is talking about the temple as different layers of clothing. When you have the coat that is very hard on the outside, but you have this soft inner layer.
Yeah.
The soft inner layer is marble in the case of the temple. Wow. And how light touches the marble and it becomes a shine. It radiates light with just a touch of light. And I think they used one of my pictures. It's a touch by light. And it was a very small space in the temple where a couple of slabs of marble come together. So you have maybe a 1 square inch place that I took a picture, and it's blown in 2 pages in the book and full screen in your TED Talk about light.
That's amazing.
And for example, in that building, I used a lens that it's not very common in photography, that it's a 105 millimeters. It's a macro lens. It's very long lens. What people would say, it has a lot of zoom. It doesn't have zoom because it's a fixed focal, but it's very narrow, the angle you have in that lens. And if you want the typical big views of the building, in that case, you don't. With that lens, you have details. And for example, I got the detail of the light touching the marble. I took a picture of one of the locks of the temple. As I said, I always try to find those details of light, of color, in the space I'm looking at.
Amazing.
I digress.
Embodied light. To me, it's interesting. Since I started this color theory research project, which I had been interested in a lot of like what we're talking about, like my entire life, I remember being younger. And I don't know if I was sensitive enough to know that the shadows wouldn't just be gray, or, you know, that they would be imbued with a little blue or something, like maybe the reflection of the skies and the shadow or something. But I remember being sensitive to things that I could clearly see that some of my friends just weren't paying attention to. It just didn't come into their minds. And so I've been cognizant of that. When I started learning about color theory, also like, why is it called theories? You know, like, it's just all a big jumble. And I've been thinking about this stuff for years, and now writing it down and making this podcast and doing all this stuff. And now it's very public, right? So people are like, oh, Ed, you're really into color theory. And has it affected your work? Now that I'm back in the studio after the pandemic, I didn't paint much during the pandemic, unfortunately. And so I'm thinking, well, how is it affecting my work? Am I learning anything that translates into what I would do on canvas? What I'm finding myself doing is just thinking more about the colors in a different way and not exactly attaching the meaning of the color onto anything, like if it's going to be a tree. What's fascinating to me is, as I'm hearing you speak of having physical spaces that you're photographing, but you're drawn to, you're processing that through how you're experiencing the light, and that is helping you to choose what's could be very insignificant little space, little parts of the space to other people. If you're zeroing in on a couple pieces of marble and it's just a couple of square inches because you're seeing the light there, does that make sense? It feels a little different than just saying, oh, I, you know, this marble is really cool and I'm taking a picture of the marble. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of going in circles.
But I understand it. I think the gallery that I sent to you, it's called Ejercicios Lumínicos. It was exercises with light, basically. During the pandemic, since we had to slow down and we were at home, in Chile it was very hard, the quarantines. The first couple of months, I didn't take any pictures. It was like surviving, basically, preparing food and taking care of my kids, and that's it.
Yep.
And one day I said, I need to take pictures again. And I said, but what? I mean, I'm stuck in here in my house.
Yep.
And I said, well, light. I have to photograph light. And how do I photograph light without being very obvious? I mean, I'm not going to photograph the sun.
Sure.
So I said, okay, what about light? How is it coming into my house? And there are 4 or 5 days during the year, in March and in October, that the sun, when it rises in the cordillera, the mountain range we have here in our east side, the sun reflects on a building that it's downtown in Santiago, and it has a precise angle that this 5 days a year, it bounces back into my house.
Incredible.
So I have to kind of, I have a calendar. When are these 2 days in March and when are these 2 days in October that I'm going to have sun coming from that building? And I took pictures of the light that was bouncing from a building that is, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles away from me, from the sun that is a lot of miles away from me.
Yep.
So I started kind of studying light and how it's reacting in my place in this pandemic. So I started making this gallery, and I found out that I had been looking at light in a different way forever.
How long ago did you realize that you had those 2 days where the light was lining up, where the sun was lining up perfectly with that building?
I think it was during the pandemic.
Okay.
Since I was at home, I could see that, and it's a couple of minutes in the morning, and that's it.
That's it. Wow. That's amazing. So you noted that and then put it on your calendar to be ready the next year when it came around.
In fact, it is Google Calendars now tells me these 2 days should be the ones that you have.
Wow. Yes.
Well, last year we had a overcast October. So
you just lost. Well, that is really fascinating.
I have eight minutes of light, maybe.
Yeah.
That light during the whole year.
Well, and I suppose by virtue of that, we have those 8 minutes of some light, some specific light every day at that time. It's just that it's not lining up and creating.
Yeah. Not in my place.
In your place. Or you could, I wonder, could you go into your neighbor's house for the next couple of days and still have the same experience and follow the sun around?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. Are you good friends with your neighbor? You could go set up shop.
No problem. But anyways, it's a very small sliver of light because it's a building that I can see that I don't know if my neighbor sees it.
Right, right.
If I look, I'm looking right now at it, and it's between two buildings.
Between two buildings.
Wow. Between two buildings that are near. So I have a small window of light from that building far away.
Interesting.
And those are the things I also try to teach my kids. Like, hey, look at this light.
Sure.
Why is it happening? Where is it coming from? And they're still small, but I do think that they're looking at light a different way.
They're kind of seeing it. Yeah. They're experiencing it, thinking about it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just, it's just the sun or I turn the lights on
A couple of months ago, my daughter, she's 8 years old. She asked me, Dad, she speaks in English most of the time. Yeah. So she said, Dad, are rainbows 2D or 3D? and I went, boom.
Yeah.
I was driving at 7:30 a.m. and she comes with this question. I don't know. I guess it's a 3D. There's nothing 2D in the world. And I said, well, it drops, so it must be 3D, but it's not usual that for an eight-year-old ask you if a rainbow is 2D or 3D.
That is true. Me as eight years old would not have thought of that. That's amazing. Well, that could be another point of research to look into. My first thought is that it's just in our minds. Well, it would be 3D. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's both. So the rainbow moves around as you move.
Yeah, but the rainbow has to use the drops of water. And water is 3D, and maybe in a very small scale. And I don't know if the rainbow has depth or not. I don't know if you just see like one plane of drops with a prism, or it's a lot of drops to the back. I don't know. So she caught me.
There you go. Checkmate.
Exactly. Error 404, file not found.
Yeah, file not found. Well, that's amazing. It's incredible to consider these things. Maybe kind of going back to just how simple it is. Such a simple question. And here I am, 54 years old, and I've never considered that. How is that? Sounds like we've got a rocket scientist on our hands. Part of this whole thing with me, with the color, is just trying to ask simple questions. Like, how is this happening? Or like noticing, like, what you notice, like with the building reflecting the sun for just a couple of hours or a few minutes every morning for just a couple of days. And that leads me to think, where is the Earth in the solar system at that time in relation to the sun? Or the color of light throughout the year itself is another one that I've been trying to figure out. Going back to the photography, you're making a representation of it. Is it in hopes of like communicating what it is that you're experiencing with other people? Or is it kind of more basic, like I just need to do this and then I'll put it out into the world, maybe or maybe not?
I think it's communicating. I was going to tell you about my Instagram, that I started Instagram, I don't know how many years ago, basically when it started. So my feed is very strange in the way that it had kind of family pictures in the beginning, and then I started, maybe I want to show some of my work, and sometimes I show my kids' hands for their birthdays, for example.
Yeah,
I don't show them nor their faces. No, nobody knows them in the internet.
Sure.
But I want to show pieces of my life, of my day to day. The last one was of a guy riding the bus with a hat, and I immediately thought of Michael Jackson.
Nice.
So that's not my work, but it's my life, and I think it's interesting to show again light and color during my day to day roundabout, when I'm going to school to drop my kids, or when I go to work, wondering about light and color again. And that's why I think it's overwhelming in the sense that there are so many questions that we can't even think about. If a rainbow is 2D or 3D, for example.
Yeah.
That we don't even know that the questions are there. They're going to get to us at some point. And just like, again, I was thinking about the latent color. It's color that is going to show. For example, in the afternoon, I don't know if the sky is going to be very orange, more of a purple hue, not so orange, I don't know. And again, why is the sky orange or blue or purple or even green? I know the atmosphere and the particles and everything, but what is the thing that gets tinted, since air we cannot see? I mean, if we hold it in our hands, we can't see air.
Yeah.
And when we look outside, it's blue.
Yeah.
Or orange.
It is amazing.
Black or and at night, and that's an interesting thing about cameras against our eyes. Cameras show us what I would say is reality, and our eyes show us what we want to see. If we are in a park, a big lawn of green grass, covered with trees with a lot of green, but if we see someone, we're going to see their skin color. The camera sees a green person. It's going to capture the real colors that are in the scene, and it's not going to process them or anything. It sees green. And once my sister-in-law, she said, "Why is everything green?"
Yeah.
Okay, where were you? In a park. Okay, that's it.
It's all the reflected light of the green.
Yeah. You're looking, when you're looking, you see the skin color.
Right.
Because your brain tells you that's skin. You have to see skin. But the camera says, nope, it's
right.
Green.
Yeah, we're now looking at Martians or something walking around.
For example, the picture of the window, with the two windows with the multiple exposure.
Mm-hmm.
My eyes were seeing a white wall with two strips of something more orange-ish. But the camera said, nope, it's blue, and the other thing is orange.
Yeah, totally. They even read like a white wall now, even though I'm not looking at any colors that I would call white.
Yeah, and you see a white wall.
Yes.
And again, it's all read by a camera, and even the manufacturer has a way of seeing colors. For example, Nikon and Canon had very two different ways of seeing color. And when you put them in the computer, your software is going to read it in another way. And when you print it, it's another thing. And if you, for example, when I'm working on the computer by processing pictures with color, I dim the lights to maybe 30%. I never use the screen in 100% brightness. I usually use the 50%, more of a real color. After that, if it's going to be published in a book, I use some saturation of colors or maybe more contrast or less contrast. And if I'm going to use it in a screen, use it for Instagram is another thing. So I have to think about 8 different possibilities of one color or the same image. I don't know.
The mystery. Well, and the mystery is driving the work, right? The passion and the investigation, which I think is just, which I think is awesome. It's a great motivation. And
yeah, and I think I'm just starting in this quest for color.
Right.
Even though I've been using it I've been a photographer 15 years already, I think. But now more than ever, I'm seeing color in a different way.
Well, I don't know if it stops. From what I can tell, it just becomes more, like you say, the questions that we don't know right now.
It's a rabbit hole.
We'll find them eventually, the latent questions. Yeah, which is great. And it reads in your work, to me, it does. And then hearing you talk about it is fantastic. Yeah, and I wonder if we're at a good point to wrap things up here. End with the beginning, the mystery of it all, as illustrated by how you were talking about how you're going to experience the colors, has an effect on what the colors that you are actually seeing, if they're printed or if, well, and the idea of dimming your monitor to create a less, does it effectively create a less artificial environment, or it hinders being able to have this like super red, red, red that just isn't found in nature?
As I was saying, the color that has been shot at us by light, real. And as a photographer said, Sebastian Salgado, it's a very famous Brazilian photographer. Nowadays, we don't have photographs. We have just content. If you don't print the photograph, it lives in just a digital world and it's not real. And if you see a picture in Instagram and then you print it, it's not the same.
It's not the same.
And again, it depends on the brand of your phone on where are you seeing the phone, on what brightness are you using the phone, if the screen is correctly calibrated or not, and again, the rabbit hole of colors, or where you printed it, if it's in RGB or CMYK, or what paper you used, what temperature was it printed on. And for example, if you have a lot of brightness from your screen and you have some shirt that it's not black, basically, the color of your shirt is going to affect the color on the screen or what you're seeing.
The reflected light from my body going back onto the screen and mixing with the colors on the screen.
So that's why, for example, on studios, you see everyone is wearing black.
Well, and then pair that or mix it all up with the incredible vast array of vision and people's, like we talked about at the beginning, like the vast array of no two people experience color the same way.
Exactly.
And then it's even more complex, which leads to more questions, which leads to more artworks and crazy conversations like this that going around and around and around. But I think one of the things that I'm learning the most about this whole project is the idea of a fact, of a nameable, this is something, doesn't exist. That's about freedom. That's about opening up. I don't know. It's as opposed to like, I got to go by these rules or something that somebody wrote down 100 years ago, and that's the right way to do something. And these other ways are the wrong way. For me, conversations like this are just deepening my understanding of the fluidity of the whole situation and just trying to remind myself to stay away from being so opinionated that I have a rule that I'm going to adopt as some kind of dogma for the rest of my life.
But people like rules. That is a strange thing. The rule of the two-thirds. Yeah, okay. The rule of the two-thirds.
Sure. Yeah,
it's a rule, quote unquote. But it's not.
Yeah. It's an option.
It's an option, yeah.
It's an option that works very well for many people.
It's a recipe.
It's a recipe, yeah.
It's you can use it or not. Thinking about one, a good exercise for me was watching Lost in Translation, the movie by Sofia Coppola. Did you see that movie?
Yes, yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
It starts very bluish.
Yes.
And Tokyo becomes a very egocentric city, very cold, not very friendly. And you feel the jet lag, you feel very lost. And the final scene is in a sunset afternoon with very warm tones, with a lot of people walking around. And it becomes a very friendly city with just a change of color. I mean, it's the same city, but shown to you in a different way. So that again shows me that the power of color. In the movie, all around the movie, you can see different scenes and how it's treated, different colors, and how it makes you feel. The first time I saw it was like, oh, I liked it. But now I love it.
Well, that's awesome. I'll have to watch that again. And maybe everybody listening, all of our listeners.
Yeah, please do.
You could have Lost in Translation going on in the background while you're re-listening to our interview for the second time.
And the music of Lost in Translation. The soundtrack is amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Sebastian. This has been a delightful experience for me. I'm just so grateful that you're so generous with your time and to share with, have this conversation and share it with the Chromosphere audience.
Yeah, more than happy to do it.
And I could keep going. Maybe we could do part two again sometime, because I could clearly keep talking for like another hour or two.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share it with your friends and family who may be interested, and follow Chromosphere, the Color Theory Podcast, on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you if you have comments or suggestions. I'd like to thank Jeremy Shapinski for writing and performing the theme music. thank you also to Grant Winkles, Susie Manili, and Jeremy Shapinski again for their production, consulting, and editing.